In his book, Glorious Mess, Mike Howerton tells the following story about a childhood experience he had playing mud football. After a huge downpour, maybe something like we've had this morning, he and his buddies got together. They found a gully that was filled with about 2 inches of water, and they had a blast playing mud football. Every tackle would send you sliding across the gully. The ball was like a greased pig, and it meant lots of fumbles and lots of gang tackles and lots of laughter. He said he remembers tackling one of his buddies who skimmed across the surface of the ground, and he thought, "I'm in heaven. This is awesome." Then he got up and noticed something stuck on his shoulder. He looked a little closer, wondering, "What is that?" He realized it was a piece of toilet paper. And in that instant, he realized the smell surrounding him was a bit more pungent than a normal mud football game. "We're playing in poop water," he yelled, and they all made a beeline for home. Apparently, a huge concrete sewage runoff drain right near the gully had backed up, and they were playing in the backed up sewage without knowing it. All right, I kind of feel like we're playing in poop water this morning when I get to Genesis 19 in our study of the book of Genesis. Certainly Lot was playing in the sewer of life. He has slid a long way down into the immoral sewage of this world. But we can learn some important lessons from Lot's life. A slide into sin is a slide into disaster. Genesis 19, I got to tell you, because I've been in it all week, of course, is a really disturbing chapter. It's a really disgusting chapter about how far a culture can slide, how far a society can go into sin. And I pray to God that America is not on that slide. It may be the most disgusting chapter in all of Scripture. With that as background, isn't that great? But it is God's warning to us of sin and God's judgment of sin. And God does judge this world, and God will judge America if that's where we end up, or any country, any society, any city, any people. We can easily slide into sin without grasping our sinfulness. And the consequences are disastrous for our lives, as they were for Lot and his family. Principle number one this morning: our moral compromise leads to immoral choices. Verse 1. Now the two angels came to Sodom. You remember the previous chapter, there were two angels plus what I said was the pre-incarnate Son of God, Jesus, that came to Abraham in the previous chapter. Now the two angels from that chapter have gone on to Sodom. They come to Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. And he said, "Now behold, my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house, spend the night and wash your feet, and then you may rise early and go on your way." They said, however, "No, but we shall spend the night in the square." Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house, and he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter, and they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." But Lot went out to them at the doorway and shut the door behind him and said, "Please, my brothers, do not act wickedly. Now behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with man. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like. Only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand aside." Furthermore, they said, "This one came in as an alien, and already he is acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them." So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. They struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. So the two angels arrive in Sodom in the evening. It is approximately 25 miles from Hebron, where Abraham is living, to Sodom in the Dead Sea Valley there. And it's very mountainous terrain, very difficult. Obviously, a human could not travel 25 miles across that terrain in a couple of hours from Hebron to Sodom. But they're angels. They're not humans. They aren't limited like we are in terms of travel. And they find Lot sitting in the gate of Sodom. Now, the gate of the city is the place where all business transactions took place. It was the center of public life. The business market would have been located in the square at the gatehouse. The gate of the city was also the place where public officials spent their day and dealt with the civil service of the city. It was also the place where the court was located, and so all legal transactions took place there. So what we can deduce from this is that Lot was probably one of the leading citizens of the city of Sodom by this time. He is a political leader in the city, a civil leader in the city, and he is there by the gate with all of the other public servants, all of the other officials. Let's rehearse for a moment how Lot got here, because it is important. In Genesis chapter 13, we read that Lot, in his separation from Abraham, lifted up his eyes and he saw. He saw the wealth of the region of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in verse 12 of chapter 13, he moved near to Sodom. He pitched his tent near Sodom, but not in Sodom. He wanted to be close, but not too close. And then in chapter 14, in verse 12, we find him, he has moved into Sodom. He is now living in the city of Sodom. And now by chapter 19 and verse 1, he is actually sitting in the gates of Sodom as a leader of the city. Lot has followed a path of moral compromise. He has been sliding down a slippery slope. And it's going to end in disaster, as we know. And it is what happens to all of us as we slide into the value system of our world. It doesn't start out bad. Perhaps Lot even thought, well, you know, maybe I can have more influence. I will be more relevant to them if I live among them and I am a part of their lives. He may have started out with good intentions, but be careful. Be careful. Because we can easily slide into the value system of the world in which we live. And our moral compromises will always lead, eventually, to immoral choices. So Lot greets the two angels. He invites them into his home for the night. That's normal. That's normal Eastern hospitality. The angels refuse at first, probably testing him. He insists. I suspect that Lot worried about them. He probably knew the city pretty well, and he knew that staying out in the public market overnight was not a healthy place to be. And so he pushes them to come, and they join him. And of course, that evening, the men of the city surround the home. There is a mob there, and they insist that Lot bring the newcomers out so they can have sexual relations with the two men, so that they can know them, is the text. Now, let me stop here before we move on, because we need to address the issue of homosexuality here in Genesis 19. As you know, many try to say that this passage is not talking about homosexuality. And the arguments go back to a book by D. Sherwin Bailey that was written way back in 1955. Homosexuality in the Western Christian Tradition. And really, all the arguments haven't changed. All of the arguments that are raised today by those who address the biblical issues and say that this is not talking about homosexuality use the same arguments that Bailey proposed back in 1955, that it is either talking about hospitality or that it is talking about homosexual rape. Those are the two ways that the gay rights movement addresses this passage. If they address it at all, of course, if anybody's even concerned about addressing the biblical record. Bailey's argument, first of all, the first argument goes something like this. The verb to know does not necessarily mean sexual relations, something sexual. The men of the city were, in fact, accusing Lot of violating the rules of hospitality. This was a hospitality issue, and you may have even heard that argument raised by people in our culture today. That Lot had violated the rules of hospitality, and he had not properly vetted the credentials of the visitors before they were allowed to live or come into the city, and that they needed to properly investigate those credentials. Now, I got to tell you that the argument would quite frankly be silly if it weren't so serious, because it is seriously proposed today, as it has been since Bailey said it in 55. Lot offers to let them know, same word, his daughters, his virgin daughters. What do we think, that they wanted to investigate their credentials for the city? It makes no sense. It's laughable to argue this way, unless you're trying to justify sin. The second way that the gay rights movement deals with this passage is by arguing that this is a problem with rape, not committed homosexuality. Many argue that rape is certainly wrong, but the passage is not addressing gays who live in a committed sexual relationship. The problem is that the New Testament book of Jude clearly indicates that the sin of homosexuality in Genesis 19 was not just a sin of rape. Jude writes, just as in Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they engaged in gross immorality and went after strange or different flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. Jude says nothing about rape. He says that the men of Sodom went after different flesh than was normal for men to want. It's different. And Bailey and other writers since him basically deal with the Jude passage by dismissing it and saying it's not the Bible. It's Jewish thinking that Jude is quoting, and so therefore we do not have to deal with Jude 7 as being biblical at all. Well, of course, that argument doesn't add up for anybody who's going to take the Bible seriously. Genesis 19 is talking about homosexuality, yes, in its worst form. And God judged Sodom and Gomorrah for their sins, which included homosexuality. Not only homosexuality, there are many other sins, and other parts of Scripture identify other sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, but certainly included homosexuality. It's one of the sins that led to the judgment of God. This is a sad and disgusting story about how far humans can go in their sinfulness, how far a society can degenerate into sin and into immorality. But it doesn't end there. I am, quite frankly, more appalled by Lot's choice than by the men of Sodom. I am more appalled by what Lot chose to do than I am by the homosexuality that is identified here. Lot, the New Testament says, was a righteous man. It's hard for me to fathom him being called a righteous man when he chooses to do what he does here, right? Lot goes out and talks to them, and then he offers them his virgin daughters for their sexual gratification, this mob's sexual gratification, rather than the men that he is protecting inside. He protects the men inside, the angels actually, inside, but at the expense of his daughters? How low can you get? I think Lot's immoral choice is even worse than the homosexuality in this chapter. How could a father offer his daughters to a mob of men for their sexual gratification? Now, I understand all the arguments, read them again this week, about how important hospitality was in the Middle East, into the Eastern culture. It was highly important. You know what? It doesn't excuse his choice at all. Doesn't excuse his choice at all. Lot has sunk to the depths of immorality. Fortunately, the angels intervene, right? And they pull him back inside, and they impose this supernatural blindness on the mob. But it doesn't excuse how far Lot has slid into sin. And it's my point. Our moral compromise starts out mild, but if it continues, it leads us into very immoral choices. Secondly, when we warn people, they laugh at our warnings. Verse 12. Then the two men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here, a son-in-law, and your sons, and your daughters, and whomever you have in the city? Bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy this place, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting, to be joking. So the angels deliver this warning to Lot. God's going to destroy the city. Get your family out of here. Verse 12, by the way, mentions that he had an extended family. Did you notice that? He has sons living in the city and presumably their families. It's not just the two daughters who are unmarried at this point. There are others. And I'm sure that Lot made the rounds that night, warning his extended family about the coming judgment. We have only the responses of the two fiancés here. They laughed at his warning. They thought he was joking. I suspect, though, that the rest of his family probably responded the same way, because none of them leave the city. They all probably thought, "Dad, you're joking. This is a joke." They didn't take his warning seriously. And the truth is that all of his family is going to die in the judgment, except Lot and his two unmarried daughters. That's it. Even Lot's wife, we know, dies in the judgment. So Lot will lose not just his material possessions, but his entire family, except for his two unmarried daughters. And that is what happens when we become so enmeshed in the world's value system. People view God's warnings as jokes. It doesn't fit the world life view, and so they dismiss the warnings. Lot's family members loved the material prosperity, the pleasures that life brought them in Sodom. They liked all of that. They bought into the lifestyle of the world so much that they didn't even value what God valued anymore. And Lot himself had bought into that lifestyle a long way. When we buy into the world, folks, we lose our own credibility to witness and to warn. When we live like the world, think like the world, act like the world, love like the world, we cannot warn the world. They won't listen to us anymore. As believers, we lose our ability to influence the world. We can become irrelevant in our attempts to be relevant. We end up being like the guy, you know, that you see every now and then as a joke who holds up the sign, the world's coming to an end or something like that. The sky is falling. Ha, 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 ha. Look at that guy. Nobody believes us. Not only that, we lose our ability to see God's values themselves. We buy into those values of the world in which we live. We become like Lot's family. The church can lose its witness. Christians can lose their witness. And we cannot take God seriously sometimes because we get caught up. We won't listen to God's warnings either. We will laugh at God's warnings if we buy into the world's values. That's what can happen. So, why can't we sin just a little bit? Why can't we sin just a little bit? Verse 15. When morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. When they had brought them outside, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away." But Lot said to them, "Oh, no, 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 my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, for the disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now, behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small." Not big, just small. "Please, let me escape there. Is it not small? Then my life may be saved." And he said to him, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore the name of the town was called Zoar. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife, from behind him, looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. "Get out of here, Lot. Get moving." But Lot doesn't want to go. He can't let go of the lifestyle that he has. His affections are wrapped up in his world. So the angels grab, literally the text says, grab the four of them and lift them out of there, outside of the city. Verse 16 tells us that it was because of, it's a wonderful little expression, isn't it? Because of the compassion of the Lord on him, God loved Lot. And so he physically removed Lot from the city and the coming judgment, even though Lot could not bring himself to do it. Sometimes I think God exercises tough love for us too. He intervenes to get us out of the messes we've gotten ourselves into, all because he loves us. That is pure grace. Absolute pure grace. Lot didn't deserve it. God loved him enough to lift him out of there. And God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves in our sinfulness. They tell Lot to get to the mountains for safety. Don't even look back. And what's Lot's response? Lot objects. Can you imagine it? These angels have lifted him out of the city. The judgment's coming. Get to the mountains, Lot. And he says, no, I object. I can't survive in those mountains. How about this little village over here? Just this little one. Let me go there, God. Let me be safe. I can't do that. And God says, okay, you go, but get there quick. Because as soon as you're there, I'm going to judge the city. I don't know. I'm going to speculate for a minute, okay? So you take this as speculation. But I suspect, if you stand in the Dead Sea River Valley, the Dead Sea Valley there, where we don't know exactly, by the way, where Sodom and Gomorrah are. Most archaeologists believe they're probably under the Dead Sea today. The where they were located is probably under the Dead Sea. But it's that region, the Dead Sea. And when you stand there and you look up to the western mountains, to the eastern mountains, and I think, this is speculation, but I think that when the angels said, get to the mountains, they pointed. And they pointed to the mountains where Abraham lived, where Lot had left, which would have been to the west. Get up into those mountains. But Lot didn't go there. He went the exact opposite direction. He went to Zoar, which is on the eastern side, and eventually we'll see he does go into the mountains on the eastern side. I don't know, maybe Lot was embarrassed to go back to his uncle Abraham in a mess with everything wiped out. But he doesn't go back to Abraham, where he surely would have been welcomed with gracious open arms. He heads the other direction. And he arrives at the little village. Just as he gets there, his wife, lingering behind, not wanting to let go, turns and watches, and she's turned into a pillar of salt. She's judged too. Why did Lot choose Zoar over the mountains? Why? What's wrong with this picture? Lot chose Zoar over the mountains for the same reason he chose Sodom in the first place. It looked good. He's simply repeating the mistake of Genesis 13. Remember back in Genesis 13:10, Lot came to a decision in his life, a turning point. He lifted up his eyes and he saw, right? He saw all of that prosperity. He saw the lifestyle that he wanted, the prosperity of the area, and he chose to live there in that prosperity. Temptation always begins with the eyes. We see. And when we see, we want. That's why advertising works and why it is so insidious. We see and we want. And Lot is saying, no, I can't go live in the mountains. Let me have some of the lifestyle that I'm leaving. Let me have a little bit. I'll go to the city of Zoar. Because I still want that, you see. Essentially, Lot is saying, why can't I sin just a little bit? Why can't I have some of what I want? Why do I have to give it all up, God? Why can't I get close without getting into trouble? I want to dabble in sin. I want to dabble in all of that. But you know what? Dabbling in sin doesn't work because you can't stay dabbling. Dabbling in sin is just the first step on that slippery slope that leads to disaster. We won't stay dabbling. We want more, and then we want more. We'll slide deeper and deeper into the sin, and in the end, we will be caught and destroyed. So Lot is simply wanting to repeat that same process all over again. The story is told of a certain African tribe that hunted ducks with a unique technique. The African tribe had all of these ducks that would land in the river, and they couldn't get near the ducks. They were very skittish and wary, so anytime they tried to get near them, they'd take off and fly. So what they began to do was they would go upstream from the river, and they'd take a pumpkin or two, and they'd float the pumpkin down the river. And as the pumpkin came near the flock of ducks, the ducks would get nervous, and they'd take off and fly. But then they'd come back and land, and they'd float another pumpkin down. And the ducks would do the same. After a while, the ducks got used to the pumpkin floating down, and they'd kind of watch it, but not fly away. And eventually, the ducks became so used to the pumpkins floating down the river that they would just stay and do their own thing and not even move. And then the tribe's people would take the pumpkins, hollow them out, put them over their heads, walk into the water, and float down the river under the guise of the pumpkins. And they'd float right into the flock of ducks. And they'd grab them and have roast duck for dinner. Okay? You know what? That's the way it is spiritually. If we learn to tolerate pumpkins in our lives, we will soon be destroyed by the hunter of our souls. Beware. Be alert. That's why we can't sin just a little bit. Fourth principle, when we value this world, we lose all that we value. Verse 27. Now Abraham arose early in the morning and went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. This was as the angels and the pre-incarnate Son of God were leaving, and he'd had this conversation where God had told him what he was doing. He stood there and he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah. He's in the high hill country now, looking out across, and the Dead Sea is actually the lowest spot on earth, so it's like a low point there, and he sees the smoke, right? He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley, and he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended in the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. So because of Abraham, Lot had been saved. But as Abraham looked out, I'm sure he wondered, what about Lot? Because the smoke was ascending before his eyes. Everything was gone. In 1798, a board game came from England to the United States and became quite popular. It was called The New Game of Human Life. And in the game of life, acquiring virtues sped you through the game and vices slowed you down. Parents were encouraged to play this game with their children. The game's main point was, quote, "Life is a voyage that begins at birth and ends at death. God is at the helm. Fate is cruel, and your reward lies beyond the grave." In 1860, Milton Bradley took the game and recreated it and called it the checkered game of life. In 1960, Milton Bradley released a commemorative edition called simply the Game of Life, and many of you probably played the Game of Life. It sold 35 million copies. And in that game, you earn money, you buy furniture, have babies, vices and virtues don't matter anymore in the Game of Life. The winner of the game is the one who, at life's day of reckoning, makes the most money and retires to millionaire acres. Remember that game? No, you didn't play that game? I did. All right. Well, in 2011, a new version of the Game of Life came out. Players attend school, travel, start a family, whatever they want. If they earn enough points, they can reward themselves with a sports car. There's no end to the game. There's no last square. You end whenever you want to end. It's your choice. The box says 1,000 ways to live your life, you choose. Values are up for grabs. You get as many points scuba diving as you get donating a kidney. The description on the website says, quote, do whatever it takes to retire in style with the most wealth at the end of the game. Retire in style with the most wealth. Lot chose the values of this world. Abraham, these verses we see, he has chosen to follow God. And now he looks toward the valley of Sodom, and all he sees is the smoke rising like the smoke of a furnace. It's gone. All gone. You know what? This stuff, you know where it's going? It's all going up in smoke one day, just like Sodom. Every bit of it. We need to get back to the values of the first game of life, not the 2011 edition. Our reward lies beyond the grave. We don't live for this world, which is passing away. We, like Abraham, live for the world we cannot see, but we know it's coming. And when we value this world, we lose everything we value because it's all passing away, every bit of it. It's all going up in smoke one day. So what are you living for? What are you investing in? Your time, your energy, your resources? You see, that's the question. Is it Lot or is it Abraham? Fifth principle. We can remove ourselves from sin, but we cannot remove sin from ourselves. Verse 30. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains. He ends up in the mountains anyway, right? And his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. God finally got his attention, that's for sure. And he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. Then the firstborn said to the youngest, our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father. So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know where she lay down or when she arose. On the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father. So they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. The firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He is the father of the Moabites to this day. As for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. I don't know, God spent an awful lot of time here on this very pathetic end of the story of Lot, because he wants to teach us about sin. They end up in the mountains. They've left the city of sin, but the city of sin has not left them. Still inside them, their values. It's a very sad, pathetic story. They conspire, they get him drunk, they have sex, they raise children to him. And they're proud of it, by the way. They name them names that celebrate in Hebrew where their children came from by incest. Moab and Ben-Ammi, son of my father. They are very proud of what they've done. They've done what they thought they needed to do. And the result is, of course, the nations of Moab and Ammon become enemies of God's people in future years. Here's the thing, we can run away from sin, but sin is still with us because sin is in us. We can't escape ourselves. We think we can handle it only to find our solutions only lead to more sin. It's still there. And you know what? Lot taught them. this. He was ready to give them up to the mob. The value system that Lot had bought into, the value system of Sodom, was their value system. They'd left the city, but not that value system. And they're simply doing what they learned to do as they grew up in life. They're living out the values of Sodom. And that's what happens. We think we can handle all of this sin, but we can't handle it. It's beyond our capability. It only leads to more sin. You probably remember the Super Bowl ad of 2013, the commercial advertising the Mercedes-Benz. It's been on since quite a bit, too. The ad starts with that 30-something man at the cafe, and the waitress brings him a cup of coffee, and he looks out and he sees workers putting up the billboard for a Mercedes-Benz CLA. And he's watching them, and all of a sudden, this person dressed all in black is opposite him in the cafe. And this devil figure is holding this golden pen and sitting across from this young man. And he says, "Nice car." And the young man says, "Sure is." And the devil himself then, he holds this gold fountain pen in his fingers. He says, "Make a deal with me, kid, and you can have the car and everything that goes along with it." Pushes a contract over to him. The young man takes the pen, and he visualizes himself in a whole series of scenes. The Mercedes takes him to a red carpet awards ceremonies, exiting the car with a gorgeous woman. Women are fawning over him. They love him. Lots of women. He's driving around with beautiful women. He's a popular model. He's being photographed for magazine spreads. And he jumps in his car, and now he's racing on a Formula One race course. And, oh, he has life. And the ad shifts. He's looking back at the contract. He's holding the gold pen, and the devil says, "So what do you say?" And he looks down at the contract, he looks out, and at that time on the billboard, they finally put up the price of the Mercedes. And he looks at it, and he hands the pen back, and he says, "Thanks, but I've got this." In other words, of course, Mercedes apparently is affordable. But it's really an ad that focuses on temptation. If you think about it, and worldliness. But it gives us a very unbiblical solution. They're trying to sell Mercedes, but I don't care about the Mercedes. But think about the value that is being taught there with respect to temptation. We can conquer sin in our own power. We can beat the devil. "Thanks, I've got this." And how often do people look around at the world and at the temptations and the struggles we face, and we go to God, "Hey, God, don't worry about it. I've got this. I got this under control, God. You can worry about something else. I've got it all under control. I've got this one, God." We don't. We absolutely do not have it. We cannot control sin by ourselves. Lot's story teaches us we can't do that, and that whenever we try, we fail, and that God judges sin, and we can slide into sin just as easily as Lot. It's a warning. Instead of saying, "Thanks, I've got this one," we need to turn to Jesus, the one who has it and can deal with it. That's the message of Genesis 19. The sad story of Lot is used to remind us in the New Testament that Jesus is coming back. He's coming again, and he will judge this world of sin. He will deal with sin in this world and in our society. And we can't do it ourselves, so we need to turn to Jesus, every single one of us. We need to turn to Jesus before it's too late. Don't try to do it on your own. It won't work. Jesus will welcome you with open arms. Run to Him. Run away from the world. Run away from the sin. Get out of whatever it is that is dragging you down by His grace. Turn to Him. He will help you out. The alternative is disaster. The only answer, whether it's for the men and women of Sodom or the family of Lot or anyone today, the only answer is who? Jesus Christ. Only way out. And we cling to that cross. We run to Him as our Savior, and He alone can help us in life. But we have to do it before it's too late, because His grace does not last forever. There's coming a day when He will judge this world. So turn to Him today and live. Father, our world is indeed a mess because of sin. We are messes, every single one of us. We may have different flavors of sin, but we're all sinners. And the only way out is to trust You, Lord Jesus. Your cross work for us, Your redemption. You buy us out of this world. And we turn to You and we trust in You and we follow You by Your grace. Help us to do so this week, I pray. And if there's anyone, Lord, here who has never made that decision to follow You, help them to do so this morning. For we do not know when that day is coming, when You will judge this world. So, Lord Jesus, we commit ourselves to You and we trust in You. In Your name and on Your credit. Amen.